You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to a new edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is being recorded on the 5th of January, 2025. Now I have two announcements. Announcement number one, I'm involved in a long-term project with my friend, Peter Quijones. I've mentioned him several times. I've been on his show many times. And what we're doing is we are going through the entirety of Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together. He's reading from it, and I am commenting on it. God knows how long this is going to take, but we're doing it in one-hour increments, as much as we can get through until it's done. I mean, he couldn't have picked a better book, and I'm very happy to be a part of it. The second announcement is that I've discovered a new sport. Finally, there's a sport that I can get behind. It's called flyball, and it's done at the Crufts dog show in Britain every year. And once I started watching it, I couldn't look away. Essentially, it's a race relay with dogs where they have to go, 40 feet, grab a ball and come back, and then the next dog goes. Now, it doesn't sound like much until you start watching it. Then you can't look away. It was like when I first discovered Australian football or Frank Zappa. It's just one of these things that you can't, once you start, it's very difficult to stop. So finally, there's a sport that I truly enjoy watching. So those two critical announcements out of the way, we're going to get to the first topic of this new year, which so far, thank God, has been going well, at least for me personally. And that's the concept of revolution, especially its relationship to war and violence. Anyone who takes a couple of courses in political science will have to come across this term. And despite the root of the term, which sometimes doesn't really have any bearing on the definitions that we use now, it's something that normally, but isn't necessarily violent, although sometimes violence accompanies it, but it's an alteration in the structures of power such that nothing remains of the old order. So in a way, it is almost inherently totalitarian. Revolutions dramatically change every aspect of not just the state system, but the social system, affecting entire countries and even continents. And things like the Industrial Revolution, almost the entire planet. The point of a revolution is to completely remake humanity on a new foundation. The Industrial Revolution took quite a while. But when we usually think of the word revolution, we're talking about a relatively sudden impulse by a vanguard party to not just take over, that in and of itself isn't a revolution, but to completely upend every aspect of social and economic life. And it's something that's a specifically modern phenomenon, because prior to the modern world, there was no mechanism by which you can do this. There was no central nodal point of a society that you can use to upend it. The technology simply wasn't there. The bureaucracy simply wasn't there. It is the characteristic feature, though, politically of the modern world, and it came about and became somewhat normalized after the bourgeois revolutions in Europe, starting in Britain in 1688 to 1871. We could debate on whether or not the Reformation would count. It certainly was violent, And it didn't take long to show itself, but that's a separate topic. Now, Marxism, I'm one of the few people who've actually read Karl Marx until it was coming out of my ears. I had no choice. But followers of Marx will say that there's a change in the state system because of some objective development of the productive forces, technology, relationships, and how a society produces for itself, and who controls it. Both Marxism and liberalism, and these are both revolutionary ideologies, accept that there is a linear progress that humanity goes through, that there is this progressive, it's a slogan, the conquest of freedom by the masses, or something stupid like that. But we can't avoid the fact that these don't just happen. There's very little spontaneous about them. They're brought about by the actions of powerful, largely hidden, or at least misunderstood, or not understood at all, organized instruments of power, usually financial. Someone's interest is being promoted. And it manifests itself in violence, the overthrow of a certain state with this end in mind, that predetermined goal, the creation of a new man. Now, there may be some spontaneous elements within any legitimately revolutionary process. 1776 in the U.S. was not a revolution. It was simply a war of independence. It wasn't meant to radically alter everything. Post-Civil War Reconstruction, different story. Although it was localized. You could say that in society, in rejecting logos and rejecting the divine truth, that people in the main will start on a path of degradation. Somehow they'll be confidently believing that they're following the path of progress and the liberation from religion or obscurantism. It's a self-decomposition of humanity based on our own sinful inclinations. It's a spiritual entropy. And behind that, the forces of evil, the anti-logos, stands behind it at a spiritual level. Practically, that entropy is called apostasy from divine knowledge, the life-serving God. And the process occurs under what St. Paul calls the mystery of lawlessness, which will usher in the end of history with the temporary kingdom of the Antichrist. But even there, there's a strong sense of organization. But any acceptance, any action in favor of a revolutionary party comes from this self-decomposition. And it's organized in the sense that it didn't come from nothing, but people can join a movement because they're that deeply alienated from objective reality. The organized component is a lot more important because this entropy is consciously encouraged, brought into law, imposed through violence by these same forces. And given the nature of postmodern capitalism, they strive for nothing short of world domination, which is why they're always projecting and accusing everyone else of that. The ultimate secular goals here, of course, profit, control over resources, and control over labor. And there's long-term means whereby that's done. So far, it's been successful, but a few countries, as you well know, stand in the way. And it leads to man who is dehumanized. Now there's no spontaneity at all because there's no freedom. Man's transformed into a selfish animal mass, and they're quite easy to manage because the regime then controls the satisfaction of their material needs. But someone in that condition is simply incapable of freedom. His conscience may have been almost totally blotted out. And we understand this as money becoming the absolute criterion, a source of power for those who create it and own it. And in a dying society like the U.S. or Britain, money comes to be associated with freedom. If you have money, you could do things that other people can't. You could do whatever you want. or so the claim is. And this is one of the main marks of liberal democracy or oligarchy, today being implanted throughout the world by force and violence. The organizing force of this is a very small part of humanity. We've dealt with this in this show several times in the past and under various guises. Jewish financial oligarchs or oligarchs in general, long separated from logos or any objective reality at all. Jews especially, in their ethnic fanaticism, chosen by God for world control over the goyim. So there's the more or less spontaneous entropy, the decomposition of the Christian world. But this is harnessed by the organizational aspect. And those two together ensure success. The very use of the word masses to refer to people refers to this blob of nothing, this abulia, this alienation. And in liberalism, it enslaves humanity. Not so much, of course, by, you know, overt violence or a guy standing there with a whip, but rather encouraging and even sanctifying this false freedom, make-believe freedom of man. Liberalism is notorious for this. As I've said before, freedom and autonomy are two very different things. But given our fallen nature, and one of the aspects of being fallen, is that it's much easier to slide into vice than to ascend into virtue. This is why traditional governments, social systems, have to be very strict, for that very reason. Because to live by your passions is so much easier than living by virtue and duty. And anyone who appeals to a population by flattering it, by giving free rein to the will, of course, is enslaving them. But it doesn't sound that way. Now, part of the success of certain revolutions in public, the party doesn't preach totally false values, but they select at least partially correct ones. Things like, you know, freedom or equality or brotherhood. At a certain level, in a certain context, these are good things, not inherently evil. But of course, they're torn away from logos. They're mentioned dishonestly. And worse, they're the foundation of some kind of recipe or dogma to create paradise on earth. This is a satanic temptation. It's the social and political version of the fantasy that you have in your head when you want to pursue a certain vice. But it's also important to note that the exo and esoteric doctrines in political theory is a very important distinction to make. And there's been a gradual decline in the Renaissance of pre-Christian paganism, starting in Florence, the Protestant Reformation, and not too long after that, the growth of the anti-monarchist revolutions under the slogan of the rights of man. But for the most part, these came under a small oligarchy acting as a vanguard or a self-appointed vanguard of the birth of the new man. So the frequency of these increases as the organizational component becomes stronger. But as that becomes stronger, their destructive purpose against the Christian system or royal states, that also increases. Now there is something new about the revolution that gripped the Russian Empire, starting in roughly 1905 and ending in the 20s. Because it began as a simple Masonic bourgeois revolution in February of 1917, but very quickly led to the takeover of the Bolsheviks, a handful of them, that October. Now, the revolutions I'm talking about, and remember, with the Renaissance, that was more a foundation for other revolutions, rather than in itself a revolution, politically speaking. But bourgeois revolutions, yeah, they killed a lot of people, but not by, you know, the standard of Mao. I mean, Cromwell, Jacobins, okay, they're exceptions. But the communist regime would destroy entire social strata. Slaughtering, you know, in Ukraine, I did a whole show on Kazakhstan. Like it or not, mass murder is part of the modern age. I'm always looking at, you know, revised numbers. In the Soviet Union from 1917 to 1959, Ivan Kurganov came up with the number of 110 million people, including 66 million in the peacetime socialist transformations. And that includes the artificial famine from 1921 to 1937, all over the new empire. So there's something new about these revolutions. But those of us, you know, you start off when you want to read Marx, you start off with the Manifesto of the Communist Party, which is to a great extent an exoteric version. But I think it was fairly accurate as far as the agenda is concerned. The first programmatic document of scientific communism, as the Soviets officially termed it. And there were four goals. The first, of course, the abolition of private property, which says very clearly this is only by means of despotic interference with this so-called right, the abolition of the right of inheritance, confiscations, compulsory labor, the establishment of industrial armies. But private property means capital. Things that a society can't live without. It's not, you know, your toothbrush. We're talking about the means of actual production, socially useful labor. Number two, of course, the destruction of the family. The community of wives, which is just a version of the sexual revolution. Public and free education of all children, which is just another way of taking them from the family structure that threatened them. Number three, the destruction of the nation. And they were clear on this. To abolish the fatherland, to abolish nationality, claiming that the workers have no fatherland. Because of capitalism and free trade, national belonging is, according to Marx and Engels, disappearing. The takeover of what he calls the proletariat, what he really means is the party, will just accelerate that disappearance. Of course, it couldn't be any more wrong. And finally, the destruction of religion. That any morality, any objective morality, is nothing more than what they called bourgeois prejudice. Right in there, it says, communism abolishes eternal truths, claiming that this is a bourgeois mentality, with, you know, orthodoxy, of course, goes back with that war with the bourgeois mentality. So on, they use these words very broadly. But then they conclude by saying the revolution is the most decisive break with the ideas inherited from the past. So if previous revolutions were about the misuse of things like, you know, rights, liberty, and equality, then Lenin, at least in public, was based on this temptation of eradicating the world from what they called evil. And this appeal is how Bolshevism, at least very early on, could deceitfully take root in certain intellectuals in Russia that normally wouldn't have anything to do with it. You know, they didn't know what was coming for them. The Bolsheviks were very careful to control their public pronouncements. Well, the eradication of evil is the eradication of us. But it was done on the foundation of atheism and materialism. Which, of course, you can't be free in a materialist universe by definition. You know, capitalism is very much the same way. So it meant man is turned into an animal, controlled by the party, and society is reduced to the anthill. But man wasn't intended for this. Resistance was everywhere. These are part of natural law, the need for private property. I'm not talking about capital here. I'm talking about the property belonging to a family, especially the extended family. Nationality, the sense of a homeland, memory of ancestors, religion, the connection with God. But the Bolsheviks were incapable of eradicating all that by terror, but it still was used pervasively. Communism was at war with nature to recreate it, but nature always includes human nature. Terror, as Lenin said, was the means of persuasion. It wasn't just to kill people. It was to teach others that this is how it's going to be, to use trauma and shock to artificially win people over, meaning that they're looking for some order in chaos. So spontaneity in the formation of the Bolshevik system was minimal. I mean, a tiny strata of the population supported it. Yeah, they talked about the people being the people's choice or something like that. Words like the people or masses are always, in most leftist systems, are deliberately vague. So without spontaneity, all you had was the organizational, violent, and terrorist factor. So it's the rejection of logos connected to this belief, at least in public, that you are building a paradise on earth, which inherently is totalitarian. There can't be any private life. And just like we talked about the spontaneous and the organizational, even this has two components. Like before, the first or the lower is this spiritually uneducated, very deceived people being led by sophists. Some of them actually believing that they could build with their own hands a paradise for the workers. And of course, that justified anything they wanted to do, especially taking away the wealth of anyone that opposed them. But the upper component was cynical. It came from the ruling classes in the West. Capitalism also, in the end of history thesis, they're going to build a materialist paradise on earth, but largely for themselves. We all know what Agenda 2030 is and what it means, both for the population as well as this small group that's going to remain. Lenin was well aware that his system was going to lead, and Trotsky too, to it, with the very fact that he mentions industrial armies. Freedom is simply out of the question. It is totalitarian, and for Lenin, there was absolutely nothing wrong with that. Totalitarian, as I mentioned, is just another way of saying there is no private life. Everything is political. Everything can be amenable to legal regulation. And that's how we live now. There's almost nothing you can say, whether it be in the workplace or even on the street now, especially in Western Europe, that can't be the subject of a lawsuit or even prosecution. Capitalism, Marxism, allegedly opposed in their goals, were very similar, and one of the things that united them was their hatred of the Christian world and the fact that they were both led by very powerful Jews. Benjamin Disraeli, former Prime Minister of Britain, mentioned this fact. He called it an alliance of skillful accumulators of the wealth with communists. He said it in Coningsby, and that was published in 1844, just before, a few years before the Manifesto. Ivan Ilyin called this the global backstage. This regime, even the deep regime, which especially back then was not willing to reveal itself. And it often, and even does today, communicate using esoteric symbols. But to achieve its goals, it uses whatever it can. Now, philosophy, religious and social reforms, uprisings against actual injustice, wars and everything else. They know what all of this is leading to. I've defined the regime 100 times. This is a very early manifestation of it. Taking into account people like, you know, the useful idiots, the fellow travelers, people who don't realize what they're fighting for. So you have a Jews in capitalism, Jews in communism, both at a minimum sought to de-Christianize Europe, and especially Russia. But they use this very radically destructive instrument, claiming to represent the lower classes, in these places where that was not under their control, Russia being an essential part of this envious collectivist communism, which Dostoevsky laid out in his famous book, The Possessed. But terror has been used in leftist revolution since 1688. And the Bolsheviks, you know, and Solzhenitsyn says the same thing, imitated all of this. Marx and Engels, as we all know, received financial support from American bankers and elites. Early on, it was the head of the Bank of France, Jacques Lafitte, who died in 1844, governor of the Bank of France, who wrote in his diary, he said, "They need help in carrying out the revolution of workers throughout the world. They are working on it now. Their plans will be embodied in a complete doctrine that will crush the foundations of secular dynasties and give them over to the devourers of the lower masses. And I pray for this." This is the destructive goal of both capitalism and communism. The regime, the oligarchs, wherever they might be found, Russia was a problem for them back then, and Russia's a problem for them now. But at least at that time, the point was to overthrow the so-called dynasties, the monarchs. Now, I've said 100 times that existing socialism and advanced capitalism are ideologically very similar. I've been through this before, but it bears repeating because foundationally, they're both materialists. They both believe in linear progress, a linear view of history, especially given changes in technology and productive organization. Economic production and the mechanization of everything is the main focus of both systems. Certainly, they see themselves, as Marx did, both groups as the apogee of the Enlightenment. They are the zenith of modernity in their own minds. Of course, both claim to be scientific, and both systems are justified on Darwinian principles. Happiness, to the extent that that comes up at all, is defined in material terms today, of course, in terms of consumption. And they define both. They define progress as this gradual movement from religious explanations to scientific or so-called scientific explanations. Both groups are technology-oriented. They're secular, if not complete materialist, anti-racist, anti-nationalist, feminist, as Stalin was and as Lenin was, cosmopolitan. They reject any static conception of human nature, or really any nature at all. They both reject objective morality, the soul, natural law doctrine, monarchy, or anything that might serve as an alternative foundation for loyalty. The national community, the sovereign state, family, church. Both groups believe that man was infinitely malleable and can be shaped with just the right incentives into a desirable citizen. Man is God. These are both Promethean systems. Matter contains all potential realities, as Darwin implied. This means that man, the initiated, we confront a flux of nothing that only becomes something once their will is stamped on it. The capitalist and industrial revolution, Marxists are identical in this regard. Neither group believes that nature is an independent realm. Both use prison labor extensively. Man, for them, is no more than a bundle of nerve endings which really no inherent purpose, and of course, nominalist to an extreme degree. Both accept free trade, internationalism. They view the world as this morality play between the good guys and their opposition with nothing in between. They all seek the destruction of the family, use the sexual revolution for their own ends. Both create mass-level industrial armies concentrated in the cities. They tend to extreme centralization. Both rely on a single central bank that controls the others. Importantly, both seek the mechanization of agriculture and the destruction of the family farm or any other kind of rural cooperative enterprise. Yeah, the Marxist version was a bit more crude, using a lawless state to smash opposition. But the liberal capitalist version, every bit as totalitarian as the Soviet version, relies rather on private sector control. They work with the state to slowly alter the moral compass of the people. And over the last 20 years, people are being sent to prison for ideas. Sven Longshanks was sent to prison for literally nothing, just because he ran Radio Albion. It's complete lawlessness. Capitalist, the regime, comes to act in a vaguely unified way through groups like Bilderberg or Bohemian Grove or all of these And these groups were meant to iron out disagreements among the elites in an informal context. So the big difference is that the Soviet system relied solely on state and physical coercion. At least there, you could blame the failures of the system on a party, on a person. It was more successful in the short term, but the liberal capitalist version, the same end, same goal, just as totalitarianism, that would eventually emerge, thanks to technology, as the winner. I guess in the West, it's possible that the ruling class, the regime, can, in some cases, differ from the government. That was the case in Vietnam, for example. The government and the ruling class were vehemently at odds there. The destruction of Richard Nixon, same thing. The present war on Donald Trump, who I know was a big disappointment. And I don't vote, but those who voted for Donald Trump, I guess you didn't realize that you were voting for Elon Musk. But in the USSR, the ruling class and the state, in other words, the elite, the party, the state, were essentially one body. And that's a key difference. But this is why I say that these are, at their foundations, very similar ideologies. And they behave in very similar ways. And one of the ways, which I think was too obvious, is that they're both violently anti-Russia. Why that? Why is that the case? Marxism didn't take over, although they did in other ways, you know, the postmodern version of Marxism, not the Enlightenment version of Marxism. But classical Marxism didn't take over in the United States, France, or Britain. But it aimed its heaviest guns at Austria-Hungary, Germany, and especially the Russian Empire. Russia, it was very clear, and you have similar reasons today. It was Suvorov who campaigned in Europe against revolutionary France in 1799. It was Russia that defeated Napoleon and created the Holy Alliance in 1815. Problems, there were problems there. We've talked about that before, but still, for the leftists, it was a nightmare. Russia suppressed the artificially engendered bourgeois uprising in Poland in 1831 and also intervened in the European Revolution of 1848. The Russian army was the only thing that saved the Austro-Hungarian Empire, physically placing the monarch back on the throne in Vienna. So that's what, among many other things, demonstrated to the elite that Russia was the restraining force. It held together the old Christian world order in Europe. Tuchiev, who the famous writer, he was a diplomat in the diplomatic service in Europe. I think I've quoted this before. He wrote in an article called Russia and the Revolution, and he said this: for a long time now, there have been only two real forces in Europe, the revolution and Russia. These two forces are now opposed to each other, and perhaps tomorrow they'll enter into conflict. No negotiations, no treaties are possible between them. The existence of one of them is equivalent to the death of the other. On the outcome of the struggle that has arisen between them, the greatest struggle that the world has ever witnessed, depends for many centuries the entire political and religious future of mankind. He was right then, and he's right in 2025. But the founders of Marxism, Leninism, saw Russia's role in the same way. Marx wrote in the organ of the Communist League, he wrote, "It was clear to us that the revolution has only one truly terrible enemy, Russia. The role of Russia is the role of the savior of the order established from above," which, of course, he's using sarcastically. Marx also wrote, "Russia has become a colossus that never ceases to amaze. Russia is a unique phenomenon in history. The power of this enormous empire is terrifying on a global scale. In Russia, this despotic government, this barbarian race, there is such energy and activity that it would be futile to look for the monarchies of older states. The Slavic barbarians are natural counter-revolutionaries, special enemies of democracy." And very little has changed since then. Russians are spoken of in the exact same way today. Engels said the same kind of thing. He said, echoing Marx, he said, "A merciless struggle, not to the death, against the treacherous Slavs, traitors to the revolution." A war of extermination and unrestrained terror is necessary. A general war will repay the Slavic barbarians with bloody vengeance. Yes, the coming world war will wipe off the face of the earth not only reactionary classes and dynasties, but entire reactionary nations. And this we will consider to be progress. And of course, this was written, obviously, before World War I. So, the Slavic barbarians, they're still being referred to as that today. Remember, Karl Marx was a big supporter of the Crimean War for this very reason. Marx called it, and Engels, a war of extermination and unrestrained terror. This explains the Leninist behavior, among other reasons, but this is a big reason for Leninist and Stalinist terror in when they took over. And it was precisely in Russia's loyalty to orthodoxy and the crown. Now, Marx was a Jew, although, you know, he was a grandson of a rabbi. He had a conception of a chosen people, maybe in a secular sense. As a young man, he was a Luciferian. His poetry is very clear about that. He wanted to replace that Messiah, and he extended the concept of the chosen people to what he called the proletariat. But the Talmudic psychology was still there. Chosen and non-chosen peoples. Non-chosen, he called them non-historical. That there are certain races and peoples that aren't worthy of the coming paradise. So Leninism, in its organizational factor, was used by the regime, the ruling classes, as an instrument for the extermination of the Slavic barbarians. You know, this was an increasingly wealthy, industrialized empire taking a sixth of the world's landmass. And all revolutionaries at the time said only until this is removed does a revolution have any hope of succeeding. Today, only when Russia is removed does a great reset have any hope of succeeding globally. This is why the party in the USSR early on was not Russian. It was loaded with foreigners, especially Jews, at its very core. So Marxism became a secular collectivist vision of the Jewish concept of an earthly paradise. Russian philosophers of all stripes said the exact same thing about it. Vladimir Soloviev, Sergei Bulgakov, Nikolai Berdyaev, Simon Frank, George Fedotov, Alexei Losev, and of course, Martin Buber, one of the early leaders of Zionism and his Jewry and humanity. There's a connection, of course, with Freemasonry, with Trotsky and Lunacharsky, A.V. Lunacharsky, in his book, Religion and Socialism. The first Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party in 1898 was organized on the basis of the Jewish Bund. Not to mention, these institutions were supported by Jewish bankers abroad. And so it's very justified to speak of that party as objectively serving the goals of powerful Jews on both sides. Of course, Marx saw himself quite explicitly as the culmination of the Enlightenment, the successor of Francis Bacon, the British Enlightenment. Religion just became superfluous then. The management of society and the state, it was declared a private matter. The only social engineer of humanity, explicitly, in both Francis Bacon, Karl Marx, is science, Comte, many others. Bacon also showed himself to be a successor of Machiavelli, an unprincipled cynic and intriguer. And of course, science is very convenient because there are no inherent moral rules or laws. I've spoken about Moses Hess before. The name gets dropped a lot. I think I've mentioned him a couple of times in the past. But when the Communist Manifesto was published, you had many elite Masonic and kind of semi-Masonic groups, very wealthy, that financed it, which made a mockery of the entire theory. These are the ultimate capitalist powers. They're not supposed to be supporting the revolutionary proletariat, even though these people had no connection with labor whatsoever. They were usually Jewish from the wealthy merchant classes. They had no connection with labor whatsoever. But like the Fraternal Democrats, the Society of Human Rights, there was something called the Union of the Rejected, the Union of Just Men, which many of you have heard of. And one of the founding documents was the Red Catechism for the German People, written by Moses Hess. The rule of atheism in Christian countries were, for him, the very definition of the final liberation of the Jews. Hess, Marx, Engels, both ideologically worked together. The draft of the Communist Creed, which Engels had put together, and then that became the manifesto of the Communist Party. Moses Hess, in 1862, he wrote Rome and Jerusalem, which is a series of letters. He says in the third letter, "Very few indeed possess the noble spirit which animated the Jewish saints. Most people are anxious to secure as much immortality as possible for themselves and themselves alone. True it is that the end of days, when the knowledge of God will fill the earth, is still far off. Yet we firmly believe that the time will come when the Holy Spirit of our nation will become the property of humanity, and the earth will become a grand temple wherein the Spirit of God will dwell. It is true the reign of the Spirit exists already, but only as a germ of the spiritual light. To develop this germ to its fullest possibility, it will create, so that it will create social values, their labor along with the Jewish people, and most intellectual, moral, and creative of the modern nations, namely Germany, France, and England." Now that's his, according to him, that's his magnum opus. Now, he's a materialist. So all this nonsense about God or the Spirit is not to be taken literally. This is pure Kabbalah. It infuses the entire book. It's a racial Kabbalah, not necessarily an economic one. This pseudo-mysticism and Karl Marx were very close. The transformation, Hess says, of the whole planet into the Temple of Solomon. He mentions in good Kabbalistic form, the separated shards of light that the Jews, as he says, along with the advanced and progressive left, will bring together in the form of, quote, social values. And he's very plain that the spirit of the Jewish nation will dominate the globe through revolution. You can't dismiss Moses Hess because he was so close to Marx and Engels and laid the foundation for early Marxist thought. In the 12th letter of that same book, he says, "The civilized nations are at present making preparations for a common exploitation of nature. This will be carried out by means of labor based on scientific principles, all social parasites being excluded. They are preparing themselves for the new era through struggles for free national soils, by attempts at abolishing race and class rule, by endeavoring to organize an association, and by the cooperation of all the forces of production. In this association, the antagonism between capitalistic speculation and productive labor, as well as the contrast between philosophic speculation and scientific work, will simultaneously disappear. I know well the need of wholesome and just labor conditions, which should be based solely on the exploitation of nature by man, is also strongly felt in Jewry." The exploitation of nature by man. What is nature here, and what is man? The Goyim, a part of nature, and men are exclusively the Jewish elite with some hangers-on. You know, Karl Marx also condemned the Jews in his Judenfrage, and he said some things he probably wanted to take back later on. You have to be able to interpret the symbols in people like Moses Hess, which is one of the reasons he doesn't get quoted very much. So in addition to that, The Origin of the Species, which of course Marx greeted when it came out with great admiration, so-called scientific communism received not just an economic, but also its pseudoscientific, racial, and biological justification. Marx said, "Darwin's book is very important. It forms the basis of my idea of natural selection in the class struggle through history." And keep in mind, Darwin himself stated that the basic theory, the general theory, came from reading economists, like, you know, Malthus, for example. And everything here seemed to focus on London. That's where the manifesto was first published in German, anonymously. 2 years later, it came out in English. It has nothing to do with science, of course. Things like the Red Banner, the Red Pentagram, May 1st, among many others. These are the spiritual underpinnings of this movement. If you read Marx's early poetry, talking about the destructive potential of Satanism, those earlier calls for revolution when he was a young man were for the utter destruction of Europe for the sake of the few. I think Hess said the same thing, just in very elevated terminology. Knowing the symbols is very important. Now, these were initially used by anarchists, which is certainly not a consistent ideology at all. But even Bakunin, who eventually turned on Marx, proclaimed Lucifer and Prometheus as the first revolutionary. The war against God parallels the revolution's war on both natural law and the church. In 1837, Marx wrote a poem called Invocation of the One in Despair. So a God has snatched me from my all in the curse and rack of destiny. All his worlds are gone beyond recall. Nothing but revenge is left to me. On myself revenge I'll proudly wreak. On that being, the enthroned Lord, make my strength a patchwork of what's weak. Leave my better self without reward. I shall build my throne high overhead, cold, tremendous. Shall its summit be? From its bulwark, superstitious dread. For its martial, blackest agony, and the Almighty's lightning shall rebound. From that massive iron giant, if we bring my walls and towers down, eternity shall raise them up defiant. Reading Marx's early poetry, 1830s, destroys a lot of his later claims, because he doesn't move on from this. He just learns how to put it in more symbolic and philosophical terms. What I just read to you, this is a set of verses for the Tower of Babel. It's a declaration of war. The revolution, later in Marx, and he believed in revolution then, it's a form of revenge, it seems, against God's ministers on earth. His patchwork is the weak, those perceived as outsiders. But Bakunin also blamed Marx for the fact that he, having spent 20 years in London, never really organized anything. I mean, the Judeo-Masonic revolution in England had already ended by the end of the 17th century. The task of the House of Solomon was already present, but it was meant to spread its influence to other countries with the aim of destroying the religious and national foundations. And the one thing that doesn't show up in any of this is labor, or unions, or actual workers. The Communist Party, under the leadership of Lenin, of course he was at least partly a Jew from his mother, he didn't have a drop of Slavic blood in him, was violently anti-Russian, no different than Marx and Engels were. He attempted the first revolution of 1905, 1906, which failed, trying to use the Russo-Japanese War, simply lying about it. The media was talking about a defeat. It was not a defeat for Russia. At best, it was a draw. Japan was completely exhausted and done for. But without a lost war, even if you have to invent it, revolutions are very difficult. Most of you know about Jacob Schiff, the head of the Jewish Financial Board in the USA, supplied money not just to the Reds, but also to the Japanese at this point, the so-called Jewish self-defense groups, as well as the Bolsheviks. And the lines here were very, very thin. Lenin was clear. The struggle for socialism depends very much on the military defeats of the autocracy. And he called for openly at the time the murder of spies, policemen, the explosions, police stations, the release of those arrested, confiscation of government funds, the immediate incitement of the revolutionary passion of the crowd. This was a Dionysian tearing limb from limb, no different than in Karl Marx's own poetry. The Bolsheviks were engaged in bank robbery, and they used some make-believe ideological justification. They called it expropriations. They murdered a bunch of people in the process. It was done from 1906 to 1905 to 1907 under Lenin's supervision. He was trying to exchange some of that stolen money, Mikhail Litvinov, who ended up being the future People's Commissar for Foreign Affairs. He was arrested in Paris while attempting to exchange that, but they refused to extradite him. Showing, you know, what was happening here. But after the failure of the First Revolution in 1906, the ruling classes began to prepare a second, far more grandiose one. And there, you needed a much larger war. Russo-Japanese War, the Russians were using a fairly small percentage of their military force. Maybe not the Navy, but the infantry too. I mean, they, you know, Russia is so huge. But at the time, Russia and Germany had no reason to be enemies. So London, of course, needed to build this contradiction. Berlin on the one side, St. Petersburg on the other, and their attitude towards, well, where's the flash going to be? The Balkan Slavs. The Freemasonic sect killed the very pro-Slavic heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, killed by a weirdo. So I don't know if you call them Serbian patriots. It's really, they were anarchists of a weird thing. This is in June of 1914. But in their trial, it was revealed that various Freemasonic sects were involved in hiring them. Austro-Hungary declared war on Serbia, knowing full well that Germany was bound to back them, despite the fact that Serbia was willing to acquiesce to everything that the Austrians were saying, but it didn't matter. And in two invasions of Serbia, they still were beaten. So early on, during the war, maybe just before the war, one of the main directions of Bolshevik propaganda was to encourage all kinds of anti-Russian separatism, using nationalism as a very cynical political tool. In June of 1913, so prior to the war, Lenin said, "Social Democrats must insist in all their propaganda that the right of all nationalities to form a separate state be absolutely necessary." And Ukraine was a focus of his because of its size, trying to attract Ukrainian socialists to his side. Ukrainian Marxists were foreigners too, but many of them were of a national type, not the international type. Now, of course, this whole thing was a lie. He hated Ukrainians as much as he did Russians. The ultimate goal of Marxism was the fusion of all nations and languages under one central party. The only thing he cared about was the overthrow of the monarchy and the destruction of Russia specifically. So on the one hand, he's talking about national self-determination very pompously, while at the same time saying in 1914 that he's struggling against all forms of nationalism in his article, The Right of Nations to Self-Determination. It seems contradictory, but in Lenin's mind, the one thing he cared about, as he says, first and foremost, fighting great Russian nationalism. Our task is to fight the dominant Black Hundred and bourgeois national culture of the great Russians. And he wrote this in Critical Notes to the National Question. That was a year earlier, 1913. The regime is willing to use nationalism for various goals. Today it's Ukraine. Tomorrow it'll be something else. Russian nationalism, a completely and totally different story. The national policy in the 1920s, the Bolsheviks, was dictated by the struggle against the Russian Orthodox people. So Lenin was trying to attract the intellectuals of the various other republics, playing on their ambition, cutting off Russian lands and granting it to them, like Kazakhstan and stuff like this. But they can't keep this up for long, because in Leninism and Marxism, all nations are supposed to die out. Same thing for capitalism. So there was a temporary period where Ukraine was praised to the skies. You had all kinds of Ukrainianization. A few years later, it gave way to the immediate repression against the Ukrainian intelligentsia. And then, of course, the slaughter of its peasantry. It's amazing how similar this is. Before 1917, Great Russians, Little Russians, Belarusians, Carpathia-Rus, they were considered integral but autonomous parts of the Rus nation, making up a large majority of the empire's population. And Ukrainians had a lot of experience in dealing with Jews. This is why Ukraine was a stronghold of the Black Hundreds and similar organizations. Therefore, the strategy, both in the West as well as Lenin, Trotsky, financed by them, was to do everything in their power to separate these various branches, making it easier to fight them. And the strategy is exactly the same today. In his article, The Tasks of Revolutionary Social Democracy in the European War, when it first broke out, it came out in 1914, Lenin said, "The task of social democracy in Russia is in particular and first and foremost a merciless and unconditional struggle against great Russian and Tsarist royalist chauvinism and its sophistic defense by Russian liberals, cadets, part of the Narodniks, and other bourgeois parties. The least evil would be the defeat of the Tsarist monarchy and its troops." The attack on Russia and Russian nationalism never rested for a moment in the East or the West from 1914 to today. The nature of these Jewish bankers and other hangers-on amongst the elite financial powers in the West, that was already a unique phenomenon in history simply because of the massive resources at their disposal. They created all kinds of organizations that used disinformation, bribery, slander, murder. And of course, their greatest instrument was the World War. The defenders of monarchy in Russia at the time were not, they couldn't even imagine the nature of this regime. Most in the West were totally ignorant of the matter. And this is part of why the mystery of lawlessness will eventually gain its temporary victory at the end of earthly history. But in this anti-Russian fanaticism, whether it be from Lenin or the regime today in the U.S., Lenin's slogan was to transform the imperialist war into a civil war. Well, of course, all revolutions end in civil war, but Lenin was prepared. And he couldn't have done it without powerful financial support from abroad. You could talk about German money, going into Russia, but the German state was totally exhausted. That money came from Jewish banks in the USA, using Germany as a middleman, and they had their own reasons to hate Orthodox Russia. I've already cited the newspaper articles at the time about the 6 million being killed or trapped or imprisoned in the Anglo-American Jewish press. The ruling classes were part of a mutually beneficial alliance with the Jewish Bolshevik leaders for the economic colonization of Russia, no different than today. The director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York at the time, W.B. Thompson, wrote to Lloyd George in December of 1917, saying this in great detail, talking about gaining Russia as the greatest war trophy the world has ever seen. The regime and their hangers-on, whether it be in the revolutionary movement or in the West, they could help engineer the famine, build the infrastructure of the USSR, provide the money and the technology for collectivization, and they could do this because they had no connection with the Russian peasantry, not religious, not ethnic, not ideological, nothing. Uprisings, when the church was attacked, which didn't seem to be essential to any kind of labor socialism. And this, you know, the Holodomor, these famines, that was done at the height of Western investment in the USSR. Sanctions? No, they were building the Soviet Union under Lenin and Stalin. It was the Slavic barbarians that had to be disciplined. The patriarchal Christian tradition needed to be eradicated. The godless five-year plan under the Jew Yaroslavsky Gubelman was in the 1930s. 1937 and 1938, 106,800 Orthodox clergy were shot. But the peasantry was self-sufficient. Now, these Jewish Bolsheviks knew nothing about farming or about peasants or about anything else. All they knew was that these were self-sufficient communities, totally unacceptable in a totalitarian state. The food supply of the entire country depended on these peasants, however. The urban populations never really suffered much from hunger. Corpses on the streets that people talked about were peasants who had fled the hungry villages. So it was a punitive famine. And you know, I've shown this 100 times, all these interconnected orders from the authorities and collectivization and the nature of the suppression of resistance. And this laundry list of laws from 1932 to 1933, essentially destroying the ability of farmers to grow food, despite the fact that exports, trying to gain hard currency, went up. 1928 exports were about 1 million centeners. This centner is an archaic unit of measurement. It's about 110 pounds. Got 1 million of those in 1928, 13 million in 1929, almost 50 million in 1930, 51.8 million in 1931, And then, of course, it went down in 32 to 18.1 million centers. In other words, the peasantry was deliberately being condemned to death by the Bolsheviks, despite the fact that there at least was enough food being grown. Mendel Katovich, who was the Ukrainian, or he was a Jew, of course, secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, the Bolsheviks, in Ukraine said, this is in 1933, "There is a merciless war between our regime and the peasantry. This is a struggle not for life, but for death. This year was the fate of a reversal of our strength and their vibrancy. Let's go hungry to show them who's boss here. There were millions of victims. Otherwise, the collective system would be lost here forever, and we won that war." But these are the people who carried out these exterminations. And don't forget, the West was pouring food aid into their creation. These Jews were brought up in middle-class families from the Pale of Settlement, taught from day one that the goyim are, you know, animals, now reveling in the power that they had seized, venting their hatred on defenseless peasants at the time. And this was when Jewish influence in the Soviet Union was at its maximum. Anyone who knew anything at the time identified the terrorist Bolshevik regime with the Jews. And the Bolsheviks were not shy about saying this. This is why they connected anti-Semitism with counter-revolution. The campaign was initiated by a guy named, a member of the Presidium of the Supreme Council of the National Economy and State Planning, Yuri Lorin, his real name, Lurie. He was one of the authors of the project to transfer Crimea to the Jews and the author of the book Jews and Anti-Semitism in the USSR. And what he said was, and I'm quoting him here, "Anti-Semitism as a means of disguised mobilization against the Soviet government. Therefore, countering anti-Semitic agitation is a mandatory condition for increasing the defense capability of our country." And he was the one who brought out Lenin's decree in 1918 to place, quote-unquote, active anti-Semites outside the law. Solzhenitsyn said, at the end of the 1920s in Moscow, every 10 days there was a trial for anti-Semitism. Unless, even saying the word Jew or Yid, unless you said it with religious respect, you could be on the dock. The exact same thing is going on today. Even the slightest questioning of the Holocaust leads to prison in places like Germany, despite the fact that their own actions were leading to a massive growth in anti-Jewish feeling. These are the people who were responsible for this mass murder. The Holodomor, the Jewish Bolshevik movement, was part of, we started off the concept of revolution. This is how everything is upended. The majority of Russia was the Orthodox peasantry, and they had to be destroyed if anything was going to, if socialist transformation was ever going to be possible. And they did it all over the place. Kazakhstan was a big one, again, the Jewish dictator of Kazakhstan, who I mentioned before. Of course, Ukraine, being a very fertile area, had the greatest number of victims. Tremendous resistance to Marxism. Certainly, it was a genocide against Ukraine, but it was also a genocide against Russia. And the genocide against Russia continued. The entire Leningrad purge after World War II was based on that. Great Russians didn't suffer any less from the communist government than the Ukrainians or anyone else. There's no such thing as a Soviet Russian. That doesn't make any sense. That phenomenon existed briefly after World War II in the Leningraders, but Stalin and Beria made sure that that was smashed and destroyed, and many of these people were shot. But this same bizarre interpretation that this was entirely a Russian attack on Ukraine back then is still dominant in the West, especially in the Ukrainian immigration. And since the wars began, it's that fever pitch levels of fanaticism, and it's being imposed in today's Ukraine. This is an elementary rule here, separating Ukraine from Russia. This is still going on as part of their war for this global revolution that Russia right now stands in the way of. This is how revolution manifested itself. It ends up being not just the ideological sloganeering was garbage. You couldn't trust any of it. Importantly, this is how a totalitarian system has to manifest itself. It has to be based on the slaughter of a Christian population. Now, today, You don't really have much of a Christian population in the West. So totalitarianism could very easily, slowly but surely, take over. And you don't have a lot of people complaining about it or understanding about it. The conservatives are useless. They're just saying what liberals were saying 30 years ago. People like, you know, you know, Peterson and Rogan, these idiots, Musk, they're there to try to attract and de-radicalize people like us. The Great Reset is imposed in the exact same way that Leninism was imposed. And Russia, in both cases, is the problem. Nothing has changed. Everything stays the same. Russia remains the bulwark against the regime. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.